If we have a government shutdown, does that mean that President Trump can finally start shrinking the government? Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of politics and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I am your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my illustrious colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward, Matt Welch, and Nick Gillespie. Happy shutdown week, everybody. Sure looks like we're headed for a government shutdown later this week, and the Trump administration is already making plans for the mass firing of federal workers. Catherine, I want to start with you. White House Press Secretary Karen Leavitt was asked on Monday about whether there would be federal workforce layoffs if the government shuts down. And here's what she said. There will be if Democrats don't keep the government open. So is this government shutdown the path to a smaller, better, more efficient government, finally?
No.
Oh, thanks.
Right. I mean, so this is the problem. She, first of all, hilarious talking points, energy here. If the Democrats keep government open, it's a Republican-dominated Congress. They could be doing their jobs. They could be doing their jobs at any time over the course of the year. Certainly, they could be doing their jobs not up against this deadline. They could be meeting, I don't know, anytime other than 24, 48, 72 hours before the shutdown to try and sort some of this stuff out. They're not doing any of that. And as for the firings, I would love to see the federal workforce reduced, but this ain't the way it's going to stick.
Well, the Republican argument here is they've passed a clean CR. It's going to keep the government open for a whopping 7 weeks if they get their way. And they just want the Democrats to go along with them and keep the government open. And Democrats, they say, are the ones who are holding things up by demanding that they continue to fund these Obamacare expanded subsidies that were passed under the Biden administration. I mean, does this, like, what do you think of that, Catherine?
I think it's not fair to say the government would stay open if only Democrats would totally agree with Republicans. Like, that's not how Congress works. I do not want to see those subsidies expanded. I, again, would love to see the federal workforce reduced. I would love to see the debt and deficit reduced. All of these are worthy goals. But just saying, why are Democrats like this is not actually the way that lawmaking works.
Matt, so we've had a lot of government shutdowns over the years. I mean, go back to 2013 when Ted Cruz and company shut down the government over Obamacare. Whenever that happens, we get notes, we get emails from libertarians who are like, hey, this seems great. We don't like the government. We want it to be smaller. It seems fine if it shuts down. So my question for you is, did any of those government shutdowns produce any kind of policy wins?
I don't think so. I would say that the government shutdowns in the era between 2009 and 2013, the Ted Cruz, Mike Lee shutdown, was particularly petulant and pointless. And after that, Mitch McConnell and other Republicans and Paul Ryan, who had actual power back then, said, we're just not going to do that stuff anymore. And that's not just government shutdowns. It was also debt ceiling increase, hostage negotiations, and the rest of it. From 2009 to 2013, the threat of shutdowns or debt ceilings did contribute to what was at that point a post-bailout, post-like stabilization spending increase kind of freeze or cap. We had a year-over-year defense spending decrease, sequestration caps that went into effect because of that. Those were part of a result of that kind of showdown politics. But since then, and especially since, again, the Ted Cruz and Mike Lee thing, which was all about whether we were going to appoint the right conference committee to make a $3.6 trillion bill, a $3.4 trillion bill of the House. And like, what are we going to do to get it? It's so hard to think of like what that compromise could be. They decided to shut it down then. After that, everyone was really tired of that whole season. Republicans lost all will to cut government. And that's why one of the reasons why none of the stupid little shutdowns that we've had since then have done a goddamn thing about limiting the size and scope of government. Just count how much more money we spend now than we did back then.
Nick, I want to ask you about whether this time will be different, but I want to introduce this by referring back to checking in on your favorite Democratic senator, Pennsylvania's John Fetterman. So he has been consistently opposed to letting a
Gentle
shutdown
John.
Happen here. Yeah, right. He's your pal, right? And what he said not that long ago is, if Democrats truly believe we're on a rocket sled to autocracy, what a great little phrase, why would we hand a shuttered government over to Trump and votes wood chipper at the OMB? I know that wood chippers are a sensitive topic here at Reason Magazine, but Fetterman was referring to the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget Director Russell Vogt, who is the mastermind behind all of these Trump shutdown plans. And I want to talk with you about Russ Vogt and bring him into this podcast, right? And sort of because he represents something that I think is really interesting and also somewhat divisive here in libertarian world, right? He has positioned himself as a small government guy in a lot of ways, right? He criticizes the Federal Reserve, the Education Department. He says that the foreign aid and development programs are just terrible embarrassments. He said that the Internal Revenue Service targets struggling families in a craven effort to sustain the broader bureaucracy's radical progressive agenda. Okay, maybe that's not exactly the line that we would use at Reason, but like he's saying the IRS is bad and like goes after people in a way that it shouldn't be doing. He basically shut down the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He's the acting CFPB chief now himself. And he helped push through a $9 billion rescission over the summer, which was the spending reduction requested by the president that defunded the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And now he's trying to use a controversial legal maneuver called a pocket rescission to cut another $5 billion. And his office put out this memo instructing agencies to consider a reduction in force if the government shuts down. And it kind of sounds like if there is a shutdown, which it looks like there will be, we might end up with this significantly reduced federal government that is kind of being run by a, I don't know, metaphorical President Russ Vogt. Is this something that libertarians should be in favor of?
No, I actually don't think so. We are in favor of smaller government, but we're also in favor of process and procedures that actually lead to results that last. The history of shutdowns, before we get to Vogt and his idea that, his ideas about executive power overriding all sorts of, congressional actions. But, you get less spending by having Congress pass a budget that spends less. You don't get it by shutting down. This is one of the lessons for the most part of all of the previous shutdowns. What Matt was talking about, where there's a flattening of spending towards the second part of Obama's regime, that's partly because it had been jacked up so much. There was not an appetite to keep spending it. But the lesson of shutdowns is that government workers get furloughed. Spending typically, it could be as little as 17% of the federal budget gets frozen for a little bit, and then it comes back fully in force with back pay and things like that.
To add some context here, Russ Vogt is saying maybe there's going to be not just furloughs here, but real firings. I mean, the word mass firings keeps appearing.
Which will also be worked out through the courts, because the executive branch does not have, this is the whole point of having checks and balances. The executive branch can't just do whatever it wants independent of congressional authorization and legal, legal approvals and things like that. And we can talk about that more in a second. But, the history of shutdowns, like if you're a libertarian and if you believe with Milton Friedman that the ultimate, size of government is the amount of spending, You shutdowns are superficially exciting, and they but they're snack food. They don't last, and they don't actually reduce the size, scope, and spending of government. What we need is a president and a Congress, or a part of people in Congress, to build a consensus to say, we're spending $6 trillion a year without even batting an eye now. That's the new baseline. We were spending, $4.8 trillion just a few years ago, or $4.4 trillion just a few years ago. We should be getting back to that, and here is how we're going to do it.
The federal budget. Like, get your macros right, calories in, calories out.
That's right.
More blueberries.
Yeah, we need.
Catherine, there was this big New York Times profile of Russ Vogt today. It sort of paints him like in a kind of surprisingly flattering to libertarians light in certain ways. I mean, like I said, it positions him as somebody who is a government cutter. Now, it also presents some things that I think all of us would be worried about. His think tank that he ran for a couple of years while the Biden administration was in power published papers saying that there was a rationale for why it would be lawful lawful to deploy troops on U.S. soil. I have no idea what this has to do with the budget. It advocated for the elimination of post-Watergate.
Or the Trump administration, right?
Right, for like Justice Department independence. Yeah. Right, we're going to get to that a little later in the podcast, right? But like he's trying to make the Justice Department less independent of, and more subject to the president. And this actually seems like his sort of core idea is, yes, he wants to sort of sweep through the bureaucracy and reform it and have less bureaucracy. But also he wants to radically increase the power of the presidency and the executive branch.
Yeah, this is, you know, as somebody who has a lifelong obsession with the size of government, this is a hard thing for me to say, but I am now less worried about the size of government than I am just straight up about the growth of executive power. And I shouldn't have to choose. And in some ways, those things are the same thing. But seeing the solution to government overreach entirely in empowering the executive, has gotten us to this place that we are right now, which is kind of freaking me out and is freaking out a lot of people. You know, we've got all the generals gathered here in our backyard. We've got really, really aggressive immigration enforcement. We've got, I guess, federal troops heading into Portland now.
It's a war zone. A war zone, Catherine.
These are the, like, absolutely no one can say that we weren't warned about the growth of executive power. This is just like very, very classic steps. I still would love to figure out a way for Congress to do its job and for the president to use his authority appropriately to cut government. But that thing, at the cost of just empowering the executive to do anything he wants ever, is not a trade-off I'm willing to make.
But this is the argument. Yeah, if Congress is not shrinking government.
That New York Times feature on Vote really drives home the fact, you know, at this point in time, he's talking about cutting certain types of agencies. But the real thing he is interested in, the real thing that MAGA is interested or MAGA and Donald Trump is interested is not reducing the size, scope and spending of government. It is about taking control of the government unilaterally from the executive branch. And, you know, when I was reading this, it reminds me of, you know, there's people in history like Oliver Cromwell and Simone Bolivar who come into power as liberators. You know, they are people that, you know, Cromwell overthrew a king and was going to replace, a divine right of total government with a Republican form of government. Simone Bolivar was the great liberator. And then they get into power and then they're like, oh, you know what? Maybe it's pretty good to start wielding power unilaterally because it's really complicated when you have to have a representative government. And I think Trump is falling into that. And this is arguably the essential difference between a lot of the MAGA policy proclivities and libertarians. Well, we might agree on saying, obviously cut Corporation for Public Broadcasting and things like that. And a lot of government programs that are pretty useless. I when we were talking about shutdowns, I looked back at something I wrote in 2013 about that shutdown where 95% of the Department of Education employees were classified as non-essential. 95%, in a government shutdown. And at the time I wrote, my response to that was, is that all? I mean, there are lots of things to cut in the government. But if you do it from on high, like Zeus hurling thunderbolts or whatever, lightning bolts, whatever they are, it ends up bad. It ends up bad in the long term, in the near term. And we're seeing this with Trump.
Just I think that there is a point to what Russell Vogt said. A dumb pronunciation of that last spelling of his name. V-O-U-G-H-T.
The Vogt.
Okay, Vogt. Matt Walsh.
Thank you. What is? his point is that compared to 100 years ago, the president can no longer easily say, hey, we don't need to spend this money because the problem has changed, right? Which is what Thomas Jefferson famously did about some naval gunboats on the Mississippi. Congress appropriated the money. We need gunboats here. But then, news
traveled. Then there wasn't a war.
Back then, the whole war thing kind of ended, or sort of. Depends on how you look at Andrew Jackson and Battle of New Orleans. But anyways, but there should be some mechanism by which a president can say, you appropriated this money to solve this problem. This problem got solved for less money, so I don't have to spend it. That seems like just kind of a rational thing that should be able to happen right
but
now.
But there is, and Peter wrote about that.
Yes, there is a and way to no. do that. I mean, they have to come back to Congress and say, you have to pass this rescission. One could argue that maybe that wouldn't be necessary in some idealized world. If you can show, I mean, this is just sort of general that we, you know, what did Bill Weld always used to say, libertarian favorite hero, Bill Weld would say that we need to get back to zero-based budgeting, but which kind of makes sense. I wish we would do that, which is to say that these agencies take last year's budget as, and you know, built in plus 3% for next year as the baseline, and it never goes away. It isn't based on we want to solve this problem. I'd be happy if there was some mechanism. I don't know how it is, and I'm confident the Russell vote is not the vehicle to make this happen, nor is Donald Trump. But there should be a mechanism where government at all levels of government should be assembled around solving and addressing problems. And if that problem is done more efficiently without spending all the money that's appropriated, be able to say, cool, we just saved money. There is pretty much no mechanism like that in the federal government that I am aware of, and there should be.
You know, but just real quickly, I mean, the Republicans, you know, in Trump's first term and now, they had a period where they control. I mean, Catherine pointed this out. They control the federal government. They can cut spending and they don't want to. So, I mean, this is the thing to think about is like these are not limited government partisans. These are partisans who want to use the deep state or the existing state or the administrative state, whatever you want to call it, to their own ends. They don't want to destroy it. They don't want to kill it and strangle it in a bathtub. They want to be soaking in that bathtub. And I apologize for a really bad metaphor.
Okay, so just for Matt here, I want to push back on the impoundment point here because that is what you were talking about. You were talking about this budgetary procedure called impoundment that was maybe sometimes used prior to, like up through Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon decided to start doing it a bunch more, and then Congress pushed back. And the reason that Congress pushed back was they said that, look, under the Constitution, the president doesn't have the power of the purse. Only Congress does. And you have to keep that like under the legislature for constitutional reasons, but also because they worried about corruption. And in a Trump administration where you clearly see that the kind of handing out of exemptions for tariffs, for example, has become a tool that the president uses to get fealty from big corporations, powerful actors. You can imagine a world in which a president had some power to not spend or spend, because the power to not spend is the power to spend, right? And could just say, well, I'm not going to spend that money. And okay, because we made the goal happen, right? Because we solved that problem. But in fact, it would just be for political reasons, because that would end up being corrupt. And Trump makes it so clear how that would happen. So to me, the worry here is both that you would be violating the constitutional design and that you would be enabling someone like Trump or frankly, someone like Biden, who wouldn't be above this sort of thing, might not be as flagrant about it, but would be enabling a president to engage in a kind of corruption by declining to spend money, by withholding that money, and using that for political gain. Does that worry you, Matt?
Yeah, like I said, in an ideal world, there would be some mechanism you can have to pass a test saying I did solve the problem rather than declare petulantly that I solved the problem as Donald Trump. And again, as I said, I don't expect anything from Russell Voigt and Donald Trump to lead to such a rational world. I think what they will try to do is to have the entirety of the Impoundment Act of 1974 thrown out, Supreme Court. You know, they have some justices on their side. They're obviously taking a legal challenge to that, and they want to get rid of the whole thing. And I don't think that would lead to good outcomes.
Catherine, one of the reasons that Democrats are mad about this, the budget process, is that they went along with the Republicans in earlier this year to keep the government open and to do a budget deal. And then Republicans did, as we discussed, went back over the summer and passed a $9 billion rescission, which means that $9 billion of the spending that they agreed to wasn't going to happen. Now, that did go through the congressional process. There is no constitutional argument that this is a problem legally, but it made Democrats Democrats mad because they felt like Republicans went back on the deal. Does this seem like a problem to you that because Democrats are like, well, if we're going to do a spending agreement, then the spending needs to actually happen. Why would we even bother negotiating with these people if we know that they're going to turn around and undo the agreement that we just made?
Yeah. It's a problem. The Republicans absolutely did go back on the deal. But
they did it to spend less. They did it to spend less.
True.
A constitutional manner.
This is ultimately sort of why I started this podcast where I did, because of course I want to spend less. Of course I think it is objectively good to spend less. And also, I think at this moment, a vast concerted effort to aggregate more power to the presidency is more dangerous than that $9 billion. And that pains me to say it. Oh my God, it hurts. Like it feels in my stomach. But this is like a very serious and acute issue that we're looking at right now, which is also a ongoing long-running issue. But to sort of straight-facedly say, the powers that we rolled back from the executive after Watergate, we regret that. Like, it's sort of self-evidently troublesome, right? Like, those powers were rolled back because
there was a whole Watergate rollback thing going on in the George W. Bush presidency as well, architected by Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, who had served in the Nixon administration, the Ford administration, which, I mean, it's a longstanding conservative project to do exactly what they're doing.
And Gene Healy has written about this, some might even say ad nauseum, both in Reason Magazine and elsewhere. This is not a new phenomenon, but it is an accelerating phenomenon, and it is accelerating in ways that are like visible in our day-to-day lives with, masked ICE agents well outside of the 100-mile border buffer, violating American civil liberties, for example. And as I say, sort of this in my city, the National Guard still in the metro stops, hanging around. So it feels like it has become more acute to me, and I think to many Americans.
Nick, speaking of things that are visible in people's lives, what about the Obamacare subsidies here that Democrats have kind of made their primary issue in this negotiation? Right, these were expanded subsidies on top of the initial Obamacare subsidies. In some cases, they went up to households making up to $350,000 a year. Yeah. But the argument was Obamacare
is really
unaffordable.
Not a lot of money. For a family of two.
But the argument was Obamacare is totally unaffordable if we don't have these additional subsidies. And Democrats are saying you got to keep them. That's our they're not quite saying it's our red line, but that's the main thing that they are fighting over here.
So
what do you think
of
these subsidies? Do we need them?
From a political, from a politics position, it really matters who gets blamed for the shutdown, because the party that gets blamed for the shutdown is the party that tends to lose the next set of elections one way or the other. And the Republicans are, they're not just saying that the Democrats are trying to maintain Obamacare subsidies, but people like J.D. Vance in particular is saying that the Democrats want to keep, they want to spend trillions of dollars on insurance subsidies for illegal immigrants. So that's the line that they're trying to do. That seems fanciful. Because it is true that Democrats have said, you got to keep these Obamacare subsidies. I don't know where that's going to play out politically. I do know, and this goes back to the problem with Trump and MAGA Republicans, is, in his first term, they had the opportunity to get rid, to repeal and replace Obamacare. And they said, we're going to have to think about that. And this, to me, is the real issue. Like, we are now fighting, or, we have two groups that are not fighting to cut spending in any meaningful way. They are fighting in order to direct it more towards their favored, constituencies. And for that reason, I really do want to see more limits placed on procedural things, because I don't want, we already know that Joe Biden was a terrible executive. We know that Donald Trump is. We know that George Bush was. And we know that Barack Obama was. Like, the rules that bind people are the way forward, I think, if we actually want to get to building a consensus to shrink the size of government.
All right. Final question. Yes or no? You get one word. We're going to go to everybody here, go around the panel. Will a shutdown be good for smaller government? Matt Welch, yes or no?
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
That's not even a word. No. Good movie. All right. Is that your answer? All right. Nick Gillespie, shut down, no. Good for liberty government? No. Catherine?
Also no.
All right. Well, let's move on here. Do you like great debates? Then check out the next Reason Versus. It's a debate series that pits reason versus other folks in a battle of big ideas on October 2nd. That is this week. Reason is taking on National Review. The resolution is mass immigration is good for America. Your friends from Reason Magazine will argue that it is. Folks from National Review will make the case that it is not, and I will moderate. This debate will be held at Hook Hall in Washington, D.C., here in the nation's capital on Thursday, October 2nd. Again, that is this week, just a few days away. For more information, go to reason.com/events. That's reason.com/events. Okay, so just days after Trump urged Attorney General Pam Bondi to prosecute his enemies more aggressively, former FBI Director James Comey has been indicted. Charges revolve around whether Comey lied to Congress, and they are somewhat vague. The indictment only came through after Trump replaced the attorney overseeing the investigation, after the previous one indicated that the evidence was maybe a little bit too thin. Critics say this is entirely about personal retribution on the part of Trump and not about prosecuting a real crime. Matt Welch, is this just a very clear-cut case of show me the man, I'll show you the crime?
Andrew McCarthy at National Review has not been a fan over the years of James Comey. He wrote an entire book about Russiagate. In today's National Review, he says, there's no case. This is so ill-conceived that the longer one analyzes it, the worse it gets. They're trying to say that because Andrew McCabe leaked to the Washington Post and then told James Comey afterwards that that Comey authorized the leak. And so that's not enough to make that plain. So, yes, it is obviously political retribution. You can also tell that it's a political retribution by reading the Truth Socials of Donald Trump. I don't know. Hey, Pam, nothing is being done. What about Comey? Adam Shifty Schiff, without the scare quotes, it's just, she's not going to get the message. Letitia, they're all guilty as hell. But nothing is going to be done. We can't delay any longer. It's killing our reputation and credibility. They impeached me twice over nothing. Justice must be served now. This is totally like calling balls and strikes, just, you know, administering justice equally. Comey's a scumbag, but this is stupid.
Okay, Nick, say more about the scumbag part of this here, right? Like, I mean, part of the
Matt said Comey is a scumbag.
Yeah, right.
Well, no, scumbag.
When you see this argument play out on social media, conservatives will be like, yeah, James Comey sucks. He's awful. And they have a point, don't they?
No, they have an absolute point. He's terrible. Every FBI director has been some shade of terrible. And Russiagate, it really needs to be reminded we need to be reminded of how awful Russiagate was. The pretext for it starting, and then the way that the media in particular kept pounding at it again and again, to a point where there are still people who are like, well, you know, except for any evidence that Trump and Russia were colluding during the campaign, et cetera, you know, it's all true. It's all true. Really, we learned that, you know, a decade ago.
Paul Manafort, but there was Michael Flynn.
Yeah, no, but that had nothing to do with whether or not Trump won the election, or whether or not he was colluding with the Putin regime, anything like that. And Comey is a fascinating character because he's somebody everybody hates. I mean, nobody hates him more than Hillary Clinton, and she has her reasons. Trump has his reasons. America hates all three of these people. So we have reasons, too. But I think, you know, the main thing to come back to here again and again is the idea that if you are just doing, you know, an eye for an eye, like, you know, we're not getting anywhere with any of this kind of stuff. And it's compounded by the fact that Trump is, reaching into the Simpsons lawyer, you know, the caliber of lawyer like the Simpsons character Lionel Hutz. You know, who is the worst lawyer in real or imagined history. The people that he gets to prosecute these cases are idiots and incompetent. So that makes it even worse in a way. But that's where I'm, you know, this is a pox on everybody's house.
On the eye for an eye tip, I mean, Democrats are crying foul here, and I think reasonably so in some ways. But Catherine, isn't this just in some ways an extension or a backlash to the lawfare that Democrats practiced against Trump?
Jerry Tuccilli wrote a column about this for Reason, and one statistic that he cited was a Pew Research poll that said that 51% of Republicans or Republican leaders now rate the DOJ favorably, up 18 percentage points from last year. And it's basically the reverse for Democrats. The idea—
Are there politics in my politics?
There's so much politics in our politics. And I think, you know, the very idea that people's opinion about the DOJ is just flipping to map their partisan affiliations is like— that is both like a symptom of and an explanation for everything that is happening here. Like, the DOJ has pursued so many prosecutions that have all the hallmarks of this Comey thing. It just, which ones you see just depends on which ones you want to see and how you're in the mood to feel. And that is a terrible way to administer justice in the country. Terrible.
It is a shame. Jerry also points out in that, or JD points out in that article, though, that the FBI really needs to be pruned back, if not completely, you know, disassembled and built anew. You don't hear a lot about that from Trump anymore now that he's running it again, right?
Or, occasionally, right? Yeah, like, but it pops back up and then he sort of remembers, like, oh, wait, I'm in charge now. And it fades back away.
And I mean, I don't think anybody
has
real—
this is what Cash Patel is going to do, right? He's a reformer.
I don't think anybody has, a belief that Cash Patel is going to run it in a particularly, efficient or effective way, except to go after, Trump enemies, real and imagined.
All right. Speaking of efficiency, effectiveness, and great administration, New York Mayor Eric Adams has suspended his mayoral campaign. He's going to become the first New York mayor since David Dinkins to not win a second term. Nick, I want to start with you. With Adams out, who is going to teach us about where to find drugs in our kids' bedrooms?
Yeah. Our kids, they're grown up now.
No, I mean, more seriously, what do you make of his record? What's your assessment of his time in office here?
Eric Adams was a mediocre mayor who picked up his game over the past year or two. And if he had been able to kind of actually convey that, partly by, the policing that went on in New York more recently has been good and effective. But he didn't do enough. You know, he had no real vision for the city. Nobody running deserves to be mayor of New York, but Eric Adams certainly did. You know, he did nothing to hold the job.
Speaking of the other people running then, Matt, I mean, it kind of looks like New York's next mayor is quite likely to be the young socialist Zoran Mamdani. Are we maybe going to miss Eric Adams when he's gone and not just because of the funny quotes?
I mean, the funny corruption, too. He started off as someone who could
have the funniest.
Could have been an interesting new style Democrat. Nate Silver infamously said, like, I don't know, he's among the top five Democratic presidential candidates after he emerged on the scene. Wow. Because he was kind of a backlash candidate to the excesses of 2020, kind of peak woke, defund the police, etc. Back when New York was swinging, all the congressional districts that ring New York were swinging red in a way that changed the leadership or the majority in Congress. And so he could have been this guy, but also he's a total, like, weird, bizarre, incoherent, kind of personally corrupt person who, like, appointed his brother for this and has a very bizarre relationship with the country of Turkey and just says crazy, seriously, some of the craziest things you've ever heard a person say, which of course is kind of fun. At least you get some entertainment out of your local mayor. But he didn't translate any of the legitimate upset that New Yorkers had about public safety or the public life of New York, about the schools after COVID. He didn't really translate much of any of that into a governing anything. And so this is what you get at the end of that. And now we get a cuddly socialist. So yay us.
In the interest of gender parity, I think sometimes people talk about what female politicians wear. And so I want to just take a moment to talk about Eric Adams and particularly what he wore to Rosh Hashanah services this year in Brooklyn, which I will put it in the show notes. It is the craziest outfit I've ever seen. Blue velvet frock coat, question mark. It has gold stars of David on it. It has candles. It has just, it's the most lavish garment imaginable. If you were making a movie about a corrupt mayor, you would put him in this garment, and then the director would be like, who gave costume too much budget? This is implausible. It's,
I like that you're always thinking about management.
I just want to know if the costume budget for the simulation has gotten out of hand. And I think Eric Adams is evidence that it has.
So I want to read you three great Eric Adams quotes here. All my haters become waiters when I sit down at the table of success. It doesn't seem like he's sitting at the table of success this week. How many apples does it take to make a salad? That is math. And where does a banana come from? This is the thing that people sort of find amusing about him, even if you don't like him as a mayor. At the same time, to Matt's point about how weird he was, this guy was just a bizarre person. And he was maybe more bizarre than other politicians. At the same time, I think he's kind of representative of, I don't know what you want to call it, like our national dipshit problem, right? Like we just have so many kind of incompetent weirdos in office. And Eric Adams seems to be kind of an exemplar of that. And I guess I just want you to pull back, Nick, here as we end this segment. Like, how do we escape the dipshit problem in America's politics?
We move to Canada and deal with the Canadian dipshit problem, I guess.
It's true with
major cities. The problem is that in order to claw your way out of the crab bucket to get to the mayor's house or the mayor's manse and whatnot, is you become an apparatchik. It is exceptionally rare when somebody is able to parachute in from outside of the normal political process. In a way, Ed Koch did it because he had been a congressman, a high-profile congressman before he became mayor. Rudy Giuliani was able to do it. Mike Bloomberg was certainly able to do it. And that's what you need because, and this is certainly true in Chicago and LA, the local governance structures are created, they are designed to produce mediocrity in abundance.
And theft.
Right. Because you have a sinecure, you've got lots of money sloshing around and things like that. And I think that is the way, unfortunately, that you get away from that in big cities by having some kind of celebrity candidate, run who is also capable of governance, because that's not always true. I mean, on the state level, Schwarzenegger as governor of California fit the bill, and then he couldn't govern. He got his ass kicked.
Is the dipshit problem a visibility problem, at least in large part, and not an underlying change? Which is to say, like, we can just see more of everything that our elected officials do than we ever used to be able to. Like, you always had to be a weird narcissist to go into politics, right? Like, that is not an underlying fact that has changed. And so I guess I wonder, like, yes, as a society, we have more space for this type of weirdness and maybe venality. But also, is it just that there's a mic on when Eric Adams says this stuff and there wasn't as many mics around before? It's at least a theory I'm willing to entertain. Kind of like...
Yeah, if I may, just real quickly, in New York, when you look at mayors in the past 50 years, somebody like Abe Beame, who was a completely characterless schmuck, he was an apparatchik. David Dinkins rose up through the system, and so did Bill de Blasio. And so... they're always there. They're always about to take control, at least in New York City. And, at least when the mic is on, we get a couple of funny quotes every once in a while. But the problem, I think, existed before publicity and will persist after.
I, too, wonder whether this is new and whether it's mostly about visibility, right? Are we testing for dipshittery more intensely here? At the same time, I think it is telling that one of the most prominent recent critiques of the Democratic Party from within is basically these people are bad at doing the job. They are bad at governance. And we are saying this as Democrats, that Democrats need to get better at actual governance and at delivering things for people, because we as Democrats understand that at some point people will see that there are no results. And I think Eric Adams, I think you see this all over big cities, big blue states. Just the governance is terrible. It is notably terrible. It doesn't have to be that terrible. All right, let's take a break. You believe in limited government, and you support organizations that champion the ideals of a free society. But have you ensured that your charitable giving will leave a lasting legacy of liberty? Without a plan in place, your charitable legacy could fade, or worse, be redirected to causes that don't align with your values. At Donors Trust, we help you secure your philanthropic vision for the long term. With a donor-advised fund, you can ensure that the groups you care about continue to receive support even beyond your lifetime. And unlike other donor-advised funds, Donors Trust respects your libertarian principles and ensures your charitable capital remains committed to advancing individual liberty. Your giving should reflect your values, not just today, but for years to come. Your vision, your values, your impact. Go to donorstrust.org/reason to ensure your philanthropy continues to champion liberty for generations to come. That's donorstrust.org/reason. Okay, we have a listener question this week from Matthew, who writes, I am curious what you think of cyclical theories of history. Specifically, I couldn't help but hear shades of the fourth turning in Matt and Nick's recent conversation on the Reason interview, when Nick asked what events will trigger us to get to the next season. I do like that we are always comparing things to television here. And especially when Matt stated his confidence in predicting, quote, in the next 6 to 8 years, likely sooner, there's going to be a catastrophe, the size of which exceeds most of our imaginations. Do you think that cyclical frameworks of history actually help us understand our current moment, or do they just make us feel like we do? Matt Welch, since you were named, you go first.
My answer is they might be useful, but probably not, and it depends on how you use them, which is to say I haven't really read these books. And when people who are super excited about them come up to me, they give off of like, oh, okay.
Matt has not read the book is like, you can always rely on that one.
Matt, yeah, what kind of big event were you thinking about when you had that in mind? And could it be a positive event?
The event is that our old age entitlement funds are going to give people a 23% haircut overnight. And we haven't done any prep work for any of that. That's the minimum of the event, but there'll be more. But that's going to happen in the next 6 to 8 years. And as much as people think that they're ready for such a thing, I don't think they are.
Just for some background here, for those who don't know, The Fourth Turning is a 1997 book by Neil Howe and William Strauss. It's a big favorite of Steve Bannon. Basically posits a generational theory of politics and economics in which things sort of turn over on consistent and predictable cycles, in which you get chaos and then you get communitarianism. Everybody's happy and then it sort of all falls apart and they kind of think we're in the falling apart stage. Nick, you were also name checked here. What do you think of this question?
I have been harping on the idea that we're doing a replay of the late 19th and early 20th century, the era of no decision, as Morris Fiorina, the Stanford political scientist, had talked about, where the old consensus that had been formed after the Civil War had faded and the parties represented a constituents, special interest groupings that no longer really had any power. I think we're in something similar. Fiorina says the way that impasse where power just went back and forth between parties at all levels in the federal government, it was resolved when progressivism became the dominant governing philosophy. And we have yet to hammer out a governing philosophy. And what worries me is actually that when you look at elements of a kind of, national conservatism and a kind of socialist, Bernie Sanders type democratic socialism, there's a lot of commonality there, which could just mean that we are going to have, forever higher rates of social spending, entitlement spending and things like that, even as we go bankrupt. I think that if we have a figure like a Ron Paul who gains a little bit more traction, or the second the second version of the Tea Party, where people across both parties start to talk about, you know, we need to be governed less. This is something that Mark Pennington, the British scholar who wrote a book about Foucault and Hayek, he, you know, we had an did an interview with him, and we were talking about Foucault had this line saying, you know, we always need to be governed less, both literally and figuratively. And it's very Hayekian. And that's what we need, is we need to build a consensus out of the torpor and the disappointment and the disaffection of the current moment, to build a consensus where people say, you know what, we need less government, and not, you know, in every possible way, and we'll be better off. I think that's how we get out of this. I don't know exactly how we do that.
I think that people really want there to be patterns. And I think it's the cyclical history. I think it's the arc of history bends toward justice. I think it's history repeats itself. I think all these things are just accidental byproducts of brains that are desperately trying to tell what is tiger stripes and what is tall grass and when the berries are going to be ripe again this year. I think we want things to make sense, and we want to see patterns, and we want it so bad, because that's what kept us alive on the savannah. And yes, I'm aware of all of the pitfalls of throwing a little Evo psych into a conversation like this, but I really do believe none of these patterns are real, and we just need the chaos to make sense.
But do you think, Catherine, with that in mind, like creating, you know, part of it is creating a story, right? That a narrative that then, you know, people start believing in. And, you know, people like Reagan, you know, talked about the new federalism, or FDR talked about a second Bill of Rights and things like that. And do you think, you know, I agree with you that the, you know, the data is infinite and you can choose whatever you want. But I mean, do you think it's possible, say, from a libertarian point of view, to create a story that is powerful enough to actually motivate, you know, politicians or the special interests that might dominate them to actually start moving in a different direction than the kind of ooze that we're just seeing over the past 20 years, at least?
Yeah, I think the only place I would disagree with you is I would say, first of all, the data are infinite, because data are plural.
Yeah,
then I would say that, you know, just because the patterns aren't real, just because there isn't this kind of like steam engine theory of like the pressure builds up and has to be released, whatever it is, doesn't mean change is impossible, right? Like, I wouldn't do what I do if I thought nothing mattered most days. But I do think that we sometimes repeat yesterday's mistake, right? Like, that is a very real human thing. And sometimes we try to repeat yesterday's success and don't get the conditions quite right and fail that way too. And some of that is the storytelling.
I mean, I think the founding of the United States was a triumph of that kind of storytelling, of limited government, individual first storytelling, obviously highly flawed. Like a whole bunch of stuff that wasn't great at the founding and for a long time afterwards, right? But it was, as much as anything, a sort of a triumph of ideas driving how society should be organized. And the founding still, for all of the ways that we're, sort of the story we tell about it has changed, for all of the ways that people sort of want to leave it in the past, the founding still exerts a pretty significant pull on the American idea because it is a great story.
If you name the founding, that counts as naming Matt and he gets to comment.
Yeah.
History is good. Read more history. That's it.
Oh, okay.
What did you say, Matt?
History is good. Read more history.
Okay. Read more history. Because you might learn about wars and stuff, like, for example, whatever's going on in Portland, Oregon, which I guess is a war zone now. Trump ordered troops into the city, is pointed to clashes at an immigration detention center. There have been some skirmishes between protesters and federal law enforcement at that facility. Most reports say it's no more than a couple dozen people camped out at any given night, at least now. And Trump has repeatedly threatened to send troops to Portland, to other cities run by Democrats. State of Oregon's filed suit against this. But Nick, we've sort of been talking about executive power here. We've been talking about the ways in which it's being abused. I mean, how are we supposed to understand what Trump is doing here? Is this a joke? Is this a farce? I mean, is this just a really dark episode of Portlandia? Or is there something else going on?
I wish that it was an episode of Portlandia, but, you know, I think, and there have been a couple pieces recently at Reason.com By Phil Magnus, and I think most recently one by Phil Magnus, co-authored with Jack Nicastro, of Reason, talking about the Schmittian turn in MAGA politics and the embrace of kind of Carl Schmitt ideas, the great jurist philosopher of Nazi Germany, of using the army to go after moments of decay or perceived disorder in society. And I feel like this is something that Trump is doing. You know, there's a logic behind what he's doing, and it is to maintain the idea that the country is falling apart, that it is crime ridden, and there are particular pockets. It could be Washington, D.C. It could be Portland. It could be Los Angeles, a neighborhood in Los Angeles. But things are so dire that he has to send in the troops, or he has to send in, you know, the bully boys. And we have to start registering all sorts of groups, real and imagined, as, national security threats, so that we can unleash the deep state now under the, control of people like Cash Patel to go after this. I find it deeply, deeply worrying, because whatever Portland's problems are, I don't think it's the federal government's role to fix those in these circumstances. And I kind of believe that conservatives mostly, until Trump was reelected, also kind of felt that way. You know, that the feds, I mean, these are people who would argue that the feds shouldn't have integrated public schools, you know, in the 50s and 60s. And now they're cheering on the idea of sending, the president sending troops into particular cities.
I mean, Matt, Portland did have a real problem with leftist protests and violence, burning stuff during the pandemic or around the pandemic, right?
200 consecutive nights of protesting, yeah. And outside of a federal building and looting and sometimes trapping the people indoors. Yeah, a very big, serious problem. And a small part of downtown Portland, a city I know very well, was turned into kind of a no-fly zone, or just a place, why would you have a business there anymore? And that's way too bad. It's the political culture of Portland has curdled. Some of it has come back in the last year or two, but it has been made in an unrecognizable way from what I remember in the 1980s. And that's bad. And also the president declared war on Portland, Oregon. I know that we are 10 years into this, and so shouldn't get overly excited about whatever the president says on social media. But also, the president of the United States said that he's declared war on Portland, Oregon. Like, that's a needle scratch moment. No, the answer is no. And I can only hope, and I don't have any real confidence. Like, I'm worried right now. L.A. In 2-3 months ago, when President Trump and Tom Cotton and everyone and J.D. Vance or Stephen Miller, they're rubbing their hands. The idea of conflict. Let's send the Marines. Let's send, for the first time in 60 years, federal troops against the wishes of the local government, both city and state level. We're just going to do it anyways. Let's do it. Let's go. And the ICE guys will have masks on, and they'll be using tactics that they've never used before. And they will be throwing sometimes American citizens in jail for 2 or 3 days as they sort of sort it all out. While they're doing that, LA, with the exception of a couple of bad, like throwing scooters on cop cars and stuff, riots, but in the small place, they basically, after that, did not take the bait. That could have gone so much more pear-shaped than it can. So Portland, which has one of the worst civic public protest cultures, with a bunch of little sunken-chested Antifa nobodies who've been doing low-level Molotov cocktail cosplaying for the last several years, it's going to be hard for them not to take the bait. And it's going to be hard for a Portland and Oregon infrastructure, law enforcement infrastructure, to mind their own business in such a way where they can successfully stay off the federal troops. So I'm worried about this, and it would be so great if Antifa was smart. And that's just not going to happen.
Yeah, it would be great if anybody was smart. This is, we have a dipshit problem in our protesters as well. But let me ask Catherine about the Antifa here, because Trump also recently signed an executive order declaring Antifa a terrorist group. So whether you call them Antifa or not, leftist radicals of some variety have been setting things on fire, causing chaos. On the other hand, there's this whole question of how do you even define Antifa? What is it? Is it an organized group? Is it something that has a leader or any kind of structure at all? How do you feel about an order like this?
I feel bad about it because I look at it and I see a slightly alternate universe where the people that I hang out with are declared a terrorist group. And it's true that we do not make a habit of destroying property. I personally have never made a Molotov cocktail and don't plan to. I don't like cops, but I'm not going to throw scooters at their cars. But that is not really why this declaration has happened. It's because it's politically advantageous. It's because this is a group that is an irritant to the administration. And because we have already given so much power to the executive to go after anyone who's labeled a terrorist, which of course creates a massive incentive to label anyone you hate a terrorist. So I don't like it because I don't like the precedent. I also think it's not going to work in any meaningful way. Like, oh, okay, let's tell Antifa to stop it. Like, who is Antifa? What? No one's in charge of them. That's their whole deal. And when you pair that with, you know, in his first term, Trump, you know, we're talking about the kind of Schmittian turn. Like in his first term, Trump said, I need the kind of generals that Hitler had. They were totally loyal to him and they followed orders. He was mad at John Kelly and said, why can't you be like the German generals? Like, this is just like normal stuff that Trump was saying during his first term. And so I do, you know, sometimes I'm like, people need to calm down. People need to calm down. Trump is not Hitler. And I don't think Trump is Hitler, but I do think that kind of thing in this kind of circumstance makes a gal nervous.
Every single time we have a discussion like this, I am reminded of the great Lanny Friedlander, who founded Reason Magazine, helped start it so many decades ago. And his like great gripe about how, you know, you look at the campus protests and you look at the police and they're behaving like jackasses and just and thugs and you don't like them, but you also don't like the campus protesters either. And it's just like, why can't they both lose? I feel that way about the James Comey story as well. It is an unfortunate fact about our politics.
He referred to them as the pigs and the other
pigs.
And
the other pigs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just great. All right, let's go to our final segment here, our cultural consumption, movies, TV, books, games, other cultural ephemera that we have been consuming. Matt Welch, let's start with you.
Why, I read Carol King, She Made the Earth Move by Jane Eisner. This is, believe it or not, the first dedicated biography to Carol King. And Nick Gillespie, that seems impossible, but it's kind of true. There was a joint
biography. How does it treat her Castro moment?
The word Castro, I think, does not exist.
That it's a whitewash.
It ends up being sort of a starter packet bio here. She doesn't get a lot of access. Carol King is famously reticent. But it's sort of, you know, it's a well-informed kind of second, third-hand put-together book, part of Yale University Press's Jewish Lives series of portraits of famous Jewish people, which we don't really associate that with Carol King for a lot of reasons. One is they changed her name. But that part of the history is one of the more interesting bits. She descends from Russian immigrants, very much a 20th century immigrant story. But for someone who is as monumental in the history of rock music, want to see some more biographies of Carol King. She wrote, for those who aren't steeped in it, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? Pleasant Valley Sunday. This is as a Brill Building songwriter.
He hit me and it felt like a kiss.
He hit me and it felt like a kiss, which is actually, that's one of the more interesting bits in here. The book details her four marriages and, of course, her huge hit record, Tapestry, as she sort of became the avatar of the singer-songwriter movement of the early 70s. But whenever there's a big one, bio done, I want to know more about the years in Idaho in which she lived off the grid with an anti-government activist and successfully sued the federal government after many, many years over a property dispute. That's the Carole King I want to hear more about. So next
tell
time.
Tell me, please, it wasn't Randy Weaver, was it?
It was somebody named, was it Randy or Rick? I think Rick it was. But it definitely it was an interesting turn that I was not expecting for Carole King. But for such an important person in the history, post-war history of rock music. And so I found it interesting just on that level and look forward to there being more bios of Carole King.
Catherine?
I know Matt is very excited about America's 250th anniversary, and I am as well. But before we get there, this December, we have an equally important 250th, which is Jane Austen's birthday, people. It is big. It is important. We need to be honoring it. You can start by reading 6 Weeks by the Sea, which is by Paula Byrne, and it is a historical novel about Jane Austen that uses the details we know about her real life and imagines her kind of in love, you know, by the water, maybe gathering inspiration for her great works. It's very good. Paula Byrne will be the speaker at the Jane Austen Society of North America meeting occurring in Baltimore. If you want to go, you could probably still get a ticket. And I am hoping to be there. And I will be attending also another Jane Austen birthday celebration at which I was afraid my very important Jane Austen-style dress would not arrive in time due to, I kid you not, the changing of the de minimis rules for tariffs, because I ordered it from a lady on Etsy who turned out to be Ukrainian. And so all of global politics came together to make me worried that my dress for the Jane Austen ball would not be here in time. But don't worry, Ukraine was peaceful enough. The de minimis laws did not prevent it. My address is here. This book is good. Happy birthday to Jane Austen.
Wow. Nick Gillespie, what do you have for us?
I believe that you and I are talking about the same thing. Peter, Paul Thomas Anderson's new movie, One Battle After Another, which is about the remnants of a 70s terrorist group called French 75. And kind of the long tail of, violent revolution of decades past. It's based on Thomas Pynchon's 1990 Vineland novel, Vineland. Pynchon is one of the muses of Paul Thomas Anderson. The movie is it's very interesting, but I ultimately, and I think it's worth seeing, but I found it frustrating for a number of reasons. Partly that it, in a weird way, it depicts but doesn't go, revolutionary violence, but it does it in a very kind of cartoon way that ultimately undercuts any pretense of seriousness. And I feel like it does not add to an interesting discussion of what's wrong with America, but it picks sides in the most kind of banal way possible. So
I thought the movie was really well made in a bunch of ways. I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson is one of our great filmmakers. I think There Will Be Blood is one of the two or three best movies of the last 25 years or so. I'm a big fan of Magnolia, some of his other movies as well. But I found this movie, like you, kind of frustrating. And in particular, I found it frustrating for the way it treats radical leftist violence, because the first 40 minutes are about the French 75 bombing places and robbing places. And in the end, the group comes apart when a security guard is killed at a bank robbery. And it's very clear the security guard isn't innocent, is someone who did not need to die. And we see for a moment a look in one of the characters' eyes that lets us know that she understands that this has gone wrong. But the movie then never really reckons with the legacy of violence, even though the main character, to the extent the movie has one, from there on out, is Leonardo DiCaprio's character, who was a bomber, who was somebody who made bombs for this revolutionary group that has an awful lot in common with the Weather Underground. And this is a movie that ultimately wants to subject that activist, violent activist left to a kind of criticism, but it's an aesthetic criticism. It is, these people are sort of ridiculous. They're sort of out of touch. They're, you know, they didn't, like, there's, you know, all this stuff about, like, oh, can he remember the passwords for, the, you know, for his revolutionary sect? And it's all, it ends up all being about language policing and whether you've studied the theory, right? DiCaprio has a question for his daughter about how to talk about pronouns with her friends and that sort of thing, right? And it's sort of enjoyably ridiculous. It's actually a quite funny movie at times. And again, very well made. But in the end, it lets these violent radicals off the hook because it simply sees their cause as fundamentally just, even if okay, sure, some of the things went wrong. And it sees it as just in like sort of in opposition to the kind of government and government adjacent white nationalist forces who are the bad guys. And you know what? Those are our bad guys. They're very bad. And I am with the movie like for half of its position, which is those forces are terrible and they should be opposed. But that doesn't let those people who did the bombings and who killed a guy in a robbery and in real life, in some cases, did worse. It doesn't let them off the hook. And the movie just sort of can't wrap its head around the fact that these people maybe just, it's not just that they were ineffective. It's not just that they're kind of ludicrous. It's not just that they're kind of a joke at this point. It's also that they did some really morally abominable stuff. And I think it's a problematic film from that perspective.
Yeah, I read it more through the lens of Pynchon as a novelist. And, you know, coming out of the 60s and, you know, many people have read Crying of Lot 49, his shortest book and in many ways his best, and Gravity's Rainbow, his early 70s kind of an American version of Finnegan's Wake that pulls together a lot of conspiracy theorizing, you know, and he's having fun with it and also kind of vaguely left-wing politics. Pynchon, when he emerged in 1990 after not having written anything in about 18 years with Vineland, which was about eco-terrorism, it kind of gets grafted now onto immigration politics, detention politics. You know, he revealed himself just not to be a serious thinker of revolutionary violence. Even that's what he was romancing. And even the writer, the American writer who's considered his epigon, Don DeLillo, who in almost every way has surpassed him as a novelist, also romanced, violent terrorism in almost all of his works. And then when 9/11 happened, shrank and just kind of faded. And to me, the ultimate lesson of a movie like One Battle After Another is not the failure of revolutionary violence, but it's the failure of a countercultural literary generation that was incapable of actually working through the moral problems of the world that they kind of wanted to have fun in. I mean, they were cosplaying as radicals. And then when the things happened in America, they kind of are like, yeah, I don't know. You know, let's just have fun with it. So very disappointing. And like I mentioned, Pynchon has a new novel coming out, which I'll probably read, but it's mostly his works now. And he's like in his 80s, if not 90s. They're a reminder that there was a cartoon version of the 60s that had a lot of promise, and it really just never delivered.
It is pretty interesting that this movie came out the same week that we had these attacks on ICE, that we've had, you know, the Trump sending in the troops to Portland because of what he says are, you know, security issues with the ICE facility, and also the death of Assata Shakur, who has been described as a black liberation activist but was a cop killer. And that was sort of papered over in a bunch of the coverage. And I think you can kind of see the relationship between what Anderson is doing, unfortunately, and some of the ways that Shakur's death was covered. All right, we got to go here. That's our show. Remember, you can come watch Reason Debate National Review about Immigration in Washington, D.C. on October 2nd. Check out all the details for the next Reason versus Debate at reason.com/events. That's reason.com/events. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you so much for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return.